For February 24th, 2017, we talk about The Inner World, Eric Wolpaw leaving Valve, and we ask you which game showed you something new about the world. Welcome to Level 185. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Jala Prendez.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. So sorry about missing last week, but recording day fell on Valentine's Day, and yeah, just didn't end up working out that great. So we had a planned night to take off, but we are back now and so happy to be back. I will admit, after that period of silence there, I was terrified because I forgot how to begin the show. So if you need a sense of how fragile all of this is and how much, how quickly it can all flee, from your mind, then yes, that is what you need. It's one week of missing it. So what has been going on? Any cool stories? Ben, I know you had a plan. You were going to go do a thing.
I got to see the movie Punch Drunk Love on Valentine's Day. They were showing it at one of the theaters downtown. So that's one of my favorite movies. So it was really cool to see it the theater.
Yeah.
So it was very enjoyable and a lot funnier than I remembered. So.
Well, something I always forget when I go back and watch that movie is all those weird little like color poem transitions that they have in between it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that play any better on a big screen, or is it still just as weird?
I mean, the movie's pretty inherently weird. Like, I remember the weirdness of it. I just didn't remember the part of, I don't know. Like, it's one of those things where you see it with an audience, like everybody's laughing at the jokes instead of just you. So it just felt more enjoyable for some reason, I guess.
Yeah.
But Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. Jala, any non-game related stories from the past 2 weeks or so?
Unpleasant things. We're not going to talk about the unpleasant things,
right?
Other than that, blow away and the crazy front that came through that damaged a whole hell of a lot of parts of different, you know, area in Texas. Like, I was kind of worried there that Ben would not be here because his house was destroyed or some shit.
Oh, jeez.
There were like all different kinds of things going on.
Was this a couple days ago, or?
Yeah. Like, with the crazy rain and the flooding and the whatever that was going on. I think it hit San Antonio worse, but yeah. So I haven't heard of any disasters affecting any of our pod people that I know of that are in Texas. So that is good news.
That's crazy. Like, this disaster season down there, does it just span from basically March through to October?
It just decides to rain for a couple consecutive days every now and then, and so you just have to deal with that.
The problem with the rain is that the soil is very clay-based, which means that the water doesn't seep up and go anywhere, so it just sits, and then it pools, and then it floods.
Yeah, lots of impromptu rivers happening.
Yeah, and
I'm not making this, that sounds like I'm making light of it. I turn phrases.
Well, and then, too, this front started springing up tornadoes and whatever. I mean, like, I would rather it be, I would rather it have rain than have dry season and wildfires and shit, because that happened in Houston not all that long ago and, you know, like a few years back. And some of the parks that I used to, run in kind of got totally torched and I went through there and it was just like ash. So crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
That's a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People are being affected by all different kinds of crazy weather everywhere, though. It's not just here.
Yeah.
So I'm just repping Texas.
Cue the end of the world as we know it.
And we're not to that album yet. Dennis, how about you? Any noteworthy stories?
Yeah, I went to the 10th anniversary of Cincy's Beer Fest.
Did you show the after effects of that?
Oh my god,
I didn't see that. What's going on?
For anyone who doesn't know, Cincinnati is a very German city and has a huge beer heritage. And so their beer fest is just insane. And this was the 10th anniversary. So it was even insaner. And we had gotten way back at Christmas VIP access tickets, which meant we got in an hour before everyone else, which meant that essentially, and we had bigger cups than everyone else.
So you poured your chalice over all the PR.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh, 5 ounces. That's cute. I've got the 8 ounce. Have a nice night.
Is this the one that's at the Duke Energy Center, the convention center thing? Okay.
Yep. Yeah. That's the one. And there's like everyone is there. Everyone is bringing their just like crazy experimental stuff. So it's just so much fun to try.
Yeah.
And nobody is actually taking drink tickets. So first off, they give out 25 drink tickets. And each is supposed to be a 5 ounce pour, which is 125 ounces of alcohol a night if you were to use all of them, which is I'm not going to get there, period.
Yeah.
So I guess it doesn't matter that nobody was actually taking drink tickets. But layer on top of that, the fact that it's, you know, I've got an 8 ounce cup, so I'm getting 8 ounce pours. And layer on top of that, that it's all the crazy experimental shit, which is like 10% alcohol by volume on average. the second half of that night got pretty bleary.
the pop science that I've heard is that it's actually more dangerous for you, or you get more drunk by doing kind of those just like a consistent flow of like a little bit of beer, specifically if you're just like sipping up on 5 ounces, you're going to absorb more because it's going to be like sticking around in your mouth and going through those membranes, you know,
so. Savoring it, really trying to get the taste of this new experimental beer.
So like how wrecked did you get?
It was more wrecked than I've been at any time in recent memory.
Like, yeah,
I think the last time I was close to this drunk was at South by Southwest last year. But that I was like, that is, I was not as drunk as I was on Saturday.
Right.
But it was like, it was, you know, I went with Jen. It was a huge date night, and we haven't gone out and just gotten wrecked together for a while.
Right.
So that was fun. The new beer that we're honestly trying to find, that was kind of like beer of the show for us, was called The Lizard of Cause by Founders.
Okay.
And it's a porter that basically tastes like a chocolate covered strawberry is the best I can describe it.
Huh.
And there were only two booths that I went back to twice. One was, The Lizard of Cause. I actually went back to that one 3 times. Just because it was so delicious. And then the other was Victory's Sour Monkey, which I don't think is like a special brew, but they had at the booth, and that was delicious.
Yeah, I like, was there a lot of sour presence there?
There was. It was, I mean, it didn't dominate the show by any sense, but it was kind of clear that was the genre du jour, or whatever you want to say.
Like, sour is the new, like, extra hoppy IPA, it seems. Mm-hmm. Which is fine.
That's fine by me because I've never been an extra hoppy guy. So I can go sour way, way easier than I go hoppy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you guys ever end up making it out to PRG, we should go to Cascade because that is a really good sours bar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you had a caretaker and you made it home fine.
Yeah, we had a DD, made it home fine. The DD was my father-in-law.
Okay.
So that was fine.
He was at your wedding, though. Like, he's seen the, yeah.
He, we spent the entire car ride home. So I guess I do remember a little of it. The entire car ride home vocally debating baby names. for a theoretical third child. So nothing to announce.
Okay. I was going to say, Jen was drinking too, huh?
Yeah.
you really do get more relaxed as you go on.
Yeah, but no, our, you know, in the event that should occur, we've at least, you know, had a robust discussion on the various baby names.
If only you could remember anything you said.
No, I can't. I honestly know there was a name that I was like, advocating so strongly for, and I have no idea what it was.
Dennis Jr.
probably. Anyway, yeah, so it was a fantastic weekend.
Yeah,
and that's me.
Very cool. Yeah,
and how that plays in is I happened to play a game with Dennis on Sunday night, and he was sounding pretty rough. So the after effects were still noticeable late on Sunday.
It sucks. Word.
like, or too much happiness from the future.
That's the thing, though, right? Like, as I can only speak for myself, but as I get older, you know, hangover symptoms like, oh, you know, a sour tummy and a headache and I'm going to sleep in, that's nowhere near as bad as just the complete loss of emotional equilibrium for the next 2 days. Like, oh gosh, I just the feeling of impending doom that comes down.
Yeah. You're convinced at one point in the night that you're going to die.
Yeah.
You know, then you come back. But no, it was really funny. So I had a Twitter exchange with, because I live tweeted basically the entire event. So I was chatting with a couple duck feeders. and you know, Phil Holmes asked how I was feeling the next morning. I was like, you know, I'm fantastic as long as I don't move or look at bright lights, hear any loud noises. And someone else chimed, I forget who now, someone else chimed in and was like, man, it's a good thing you don't have kids then.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
At any point, did you have to close one eye to focus on your phone?
Oh, man, I was so far past that point. Like, I was too, I'm going to crawl the rest of the way up the stairs because walking is not happening anymore in the night.
Oh, jeez.
There was a lot of, oh, daddy's sick, Lukey.
Daddy's sick, Lukey.
Do you want to watch another show?
Please don't make me open my eyes. Just tell me when I'm over the red button.
No, daddy can't turn it up.
Oh. Oh, gosh. Want me to cut any of that out?
No, you're fine. I've got one of those nights in me maybe every year or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah. No,
I'll revel in it.
Oh. And I've been comparatively boring. I got a camera for my deck to take pictures of birds.
I know. I've totally been enjoying your bird pictures.
Yeah.
They've been so charming.
And squirrels.
Yep, the one of the squirrel, the weird like side like back view of the squirrel. So spring's coming up and I want, you know, I really enjoy spending time on and taking care of my deck and feeding the birds and stuff, and I had a little bit of Christmas money left over, so I ordered a bird photo booth, which is like a waterproof box that you can get like a little motion sensing GoPro for. And so like in the morning I'll, you know, take it out there, set it up, it's on a tripod, put a little bit of seed in the dish, and then I come back, and just as part of my routine for the past couple days, it's been to just import those photos and like scan through and find cool ones and then post them on Instagram. So I'm Cole Ross on Instagram. I'm trying to dial in exactly how often I want to post those, because when spring comes, we're just going to get, you know, more customers on that. But mm-hmm. I'm already enough of a weirdo online that I don't know if like just solely being bird guy on Instagram is going to do wonders for people's estimation of my sanity. That is probably just being very insecure and self-aware, but that's about where I'm at.
I predict, I'm calling it right now, it's going to take off in a bigger way than you expect, and pretty soon podcasting is going to be your side piece.
Instead of a new network bird called Instagram. Bird Feed.
Bird, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Check the live feed, you can check the bird feed.
Well, there is a hashtag Birdstagram.
Birdstagram, so, really?
Yeah, yeah. In Instagram, you can add hashtags, and one of them is Birdstagram. And anytime I take pictures of my birds, I hashtag Birdstagram.
And people they search on this hashtag?
Uh-huh, they do. So you can put all kinds of hashtags on there.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And then all these people will see your birds.
Okay.
It's 90% people who use the hashtag trying to see how high they rank in that hashtag usage.
I can say that as somebody who has a bird, I just like seeing birds.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I follow bird people. there's the Japanese guy who has a little, I forget the type of parrotlet, but it's a little blue bird, and it's funny because it always sleeps on a remote control, and if you move the remote control, it like runs over and sits on it again. It's the cutest thing ever. I'll share it. It's very cute.
Please do. But yeah, that's my big thing, along with some exciting stuff that you're probably going to be seeing here pretty soon. Real busy, chicken with head cut off kind of stuff, but cool. Well, that is a little bit more banter than usual, but we've been away for a little bit. We've got the usual kind of show for you, the brief, the multiplayer, and the grind, and we're going to get started with
the brief,
where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games. So for maximum topicality, Ben, I want you to talk about the recent developments with Valve.
Yeah, so short story, but the guy who wrote, who was one of the writers for Portal and Portal 2 and Half-Life Episode 1 and 2, Eric Volpal, I believe is how you pronounce his name, has left Valve. Last year, it was confirmed that he was working on Psychonauts 2. He was also a writer on Psychonauts 1 when it came out. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of solidifying that he's leaving the company and that he's going to just be working on that. When asked what his plans were after leaving Valve, he said he was going to work at his niece's juice shop in Cleveland. So,
oh wow, well, yeah. Paul's from Cleveland. That makes sense. Why Aperture would have been based there?
Oh, I didn't even know that. Yeah. Where is that in the game, or is that like?
Yeah, it might be apocryphal and just based on some assets from the first game. But there's a map that shows that it's that's a little bit to the east of Cleveland, I think.
Okay, yeah. That's cool. I'm trying to think now. So, but there's like the ship in Portal 2, right?
Oh, the Borealis. So
so maybe that heads out to Lake Erie and then maybe somewhere from there.
Maybe.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I had no idea he was one half of Old Man Murray. I literally thought that Old Man Murray was just a dude named Murray.
So I and in the article that I talked about, it also mentioned that one of the other writers at Valve had left last year. So it's curious if like if they're just not getting work, or if they're not making games anymore, or I don't know. But in any case, it's kind of a bummer since Portal and Portal 2 were really well written games. So,
mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, them leaving Valve just means that we're actually going to get to see them write something that isn't Dota copy. You know, sometime in the next 10 years. So,
yeah.
And did it, I don't know if it was explicit or implied that there was any kind of bad blood in them leaving. I haven't read the article, but was there anything on that front? I'd say for a company Valve size to have like a writer leave a year doesn't feel like too weird.
Huge deal.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this guy's a very notable one. So, that's going to have an impact, but
yeah,
you know, I don't know if I would use this article to like call out any like, ooh, what's going on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We can confirm that he's not working on Half-Life 3 right now.
Or all of his work was already done.
That's true.
Gabe Newell gave like a surprise interview to a bunch of people. And of course, there was the requisite question about Half-Life 3. And there was, of course, the requisite non-answer. So,
yeah. I think I mentioned this when he was doing a Reddit AMA. And so everyone was numbering their questions as 1, 2, 1, episode 1, 1, episode 2.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything more about that. Any objections? Moving on.
Move on.
Yeah.
Jala, I'm curious about this story relating to military service and games.
Yeah, so I came across an article where an Army veteran basically was talking about how video games helped with his PTSD. Now, for anybody who doesn't know, I think I've mentioned this in some places before. I actually had a friend who served in Afghanistan, and when he returned home and left the military, he ended up committing suicide. He couldn't adapt to being back home. He couldn't deal with the PTSD, that kind of thing. And so he died at age 23. And so this is a topic that is near and dear to me, and I know it's been a while since the last time I talked about the alternative uses for video games, but here we go. This is something that I harbor interest in.
Yeah.
So and the Army vet that this article mentioned is named Richard Shoemaker, and he was suffering from constant headaches, nightmares, anxiety, pretty typical stuff for people who have PTSD. He'd been to several different doctors and tried a bunch of different types of treatment, but nothing was helping him. And then in 2011, he happened to see a new doctor who said, hey, why don't you try playing video games for a couple of hours a day? Just plug it in and just go. And so he got like an Xbox and he started playing games like Madden. And he does all sports games and stuff. And he credits video games for stimulating his hands and his mind enough that his headache started to subside and he felt more relaxed, like his spirit was lifted, and he veered away from suicide. And he basically said, if it wasn't for video games, I probably would not be alive right now. So, although games as a supplement to medical treatment is a highly debated topic, you know, this has been brought up several times on the show before when I've brought other articles of this ilk, researchers theorize that certain types of games basically end up setting you into the mind state that you have during yoga. They don't say that in the article, but they do say that the mind state that you're in activates the parasympathetic nervous system and alleviates stress, and that's what yoga does. So
yeah,
I know that because I used to teach yoga, so like, you know, whoa. So, you know, obviously it takes a certain type of game to do that. You know, playing Super Meat Boy is not going to get you there. But, <Right. laughs> you know, anyway, there are a couple of organizations that do stuff for this. There's a Texas nonprofit called Operation Supply Drop, which provides video games to active duty personnel and veterans who have returned home. And there's also another one called Stack Up that delivers similar items to vets that are in military hospitals. And you can donate to those organizations at operationsupplydrop.org and stack-up.org. Operation Supply Drop actually only takes money donations from what I can see on the website, but Stack Up has an address for physical donations if you have old games you want to get rid of. They have registry, so you can become a fundraiser to do a charity live stream or some such. And they also have a Humble Bundle charity link, so if you can use their link from their site to give them a kickback as well. They also have an Amazon one.
Yeah.
So if anybody else has interest in this kind of thing and wants to kind of help out with, you know, via gaming for the military people who have come back and are struggling with PTSD and, you know, acclimating and everything like that, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah. I had no idea that there were multiple organizations that have done stuff like this. I've read about Operation Supply Drop before. You know, other people have done fundraising for them. Both of those organizations are in the show notes. I've just added them as links.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. The article, I don't think gives... Oh, no, here he is. Yeah, 58-year-old retired Army sergeant. So... this guy is not near typical, you know, fresh back from war demographic. This is an older guy.
He's been dealing with it for a while. So
yeah,
But isn't in the demographic that you would kind of assume would gravitate to video games. So kudos to this doctor for trying something new.
There's research about this. Specifically, there's a correlation between researchers who were looking at the Tetris effect, like the idea, like specifically with Tetris, if you play it for a long time, you continue kind of playing it, like running the routines of the patterns in your head. It doesn't just apply to Tetris, but it applies to other games. But like specifically inducing that effect can help specifically ease PTSD and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Related to PTSD. So like there's a basis for this. It wasn't just a, you know, this one, you know, crazy doctor saying this.
The thing is that, like, you know, it's been a debated topic. There are studies that show that yes, it helps, and then, you know, there's a bunch of naysayers that say, well, no, it's not, you know, it's not a substitute for medical care, which of course it's not.
Yeah, nobody's saying that, you know, everything is a combination of everything.
Yeah, but this is something that I know you know, people who have, you know, even the times that I've struggled with depression or anxiety or whatever, if I play something that's just not stressful, like I've been dealing with a lot of stuff lately and I've been playing like point and click adventure games and, you know, simpler, easier stuff that's just kind of like I can just like play it and not have to stress out about it. You know, like it's not like, okay, I'm going to fail. I'm going to die. Damn. Yeah. You know, like I've been playing visual novel and things like that. So, you know, I know it helps me depending on the type of game that I'm playing. So, you know, and you know, what's interesting to me is that I was reading through on the, one of the websites, and they were talking about how they even will give them stuff like Call of Duty. I'm like, what? to have PTSD, why would you give them Call of Duty?
That seems very strange.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't even know. So they will take any games, I guess.
Yeah,
so,
well, I mean, like, I mean...
What helps one person? I mean, you know, maybe it's counterintuitive to you, but if it works for that guy, okay.
Yeah. Well, it's like with any kind of mental condition. I've heard this specifically related to autism spectrum disorders, but it's like if you meet one person with... you know, a condition like this, you've met one person with a condition like this. I mean, it's like, incredibly varied, incredibly, you know, kind of personalized. But still, it is great that there is, you know, a wide variety of subject matter that is being explored in games and kind of always has been. Like, these things that are off to the side have been around for a while. But just, you know, the tremendous amount of variety that we see so far, you know, that we see is a good thing, you know, for people looking to, you know, achieve stuff like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Into it. Yeah. It's awesome that this guy has been able to make his life better.
Yep.
Yeah. I have a short story, and this is actually kind of just like a little trifle, honestly. It's related to an ancient kind of Atari thing that we talked about a couple years back on Abject Suffering. Specifically, we played a game called Sword Quest Earthworld, which was part of this four-game-long series, four games for the different elements, so Fire World, Water World, and then I believe it was Air World that never came out, that were actually kind of like part of this weird like transmedia partnership between Atari and DC, putting out these comics that contained you know, the broader story of these games. They were tie-ins, but also contained clues about, you know, symbols and mysteries inside these Atari 2600 games that would lead up to this $150,000 in prizes, which included things like, you know, golden chalices and like medallions and amulets and shit, all of which were never given away because of, you know, Atari's terrible financial straits. And these comics were kind of lost to the world a little bit, lost you know, to everybody except for like collectors, and Air World, you know, never came out. It was never had anything to tie in with. But now, apropos of basically nothing, these things are being published again. So starting in May, we're gonna start getting these Sword Quest comics again tied into this crazy like get rich quick transmedia puzzle scheme from the depths of depravity of the video game market crash.
This is crazy.
Yay!
They're selling them for 25 cents too.
It makes no sense at all.
What the hell? Someone who like worked at the printer that did the last run of these before they shut it all down has had just like a dumpster of these things sitting in their garage for however many years.
Yeah.
And then they're just like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's do this. So are these bland just straight up repeats of the old ones, or is it looks like there might be new cover art, or
That's the sense that I get.
Huh. That's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if it's going to be like a reissue, or if it's going to be like a continuation of this obviously vibrant vibrant IP. Yeah, I don't know. I'll put a link to that episode of Abject Suffering in the show notes here, because that one was a lot of fun. Just like this crazy excess of that time in game development is something to behold. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, Dennis, round us out. What you got for us?
Yeah. So, Jala, I believe you talked about Sundered on the episode where you talked about PAX, right?
Yeah, totally did.
And I missed being on there to record that episode, so I got to listen to it. And, you know, I heard you talk about it. I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. Yeah, that's nice. But I stumbled onto a GIF, just a single GIF that I didn't realize was from Sundered when I saw it. And it is like the single most just intriguing, awesome thing in the world.
Yeah.
That has driven to me to use my segment on a non-visual podcast to reinforce Jala's statement of, no, seriously, go look at this game, because seeing is believing on this game. So the game is Sundered. I think I mentioned that. It's got this beautiful hand-drawn style. The story is basically the, you know, post-apocalypse, crazy world has ended, and you're running around this ancient cavern that has the power source that ended the world, and all the crazy things that that has caused. But just the design on this stuff, there's two factions. There's like crazy mad scientists and then like cultists, essentially. And the GIF that I found is of, I think it's one of these crazy mad scientists. Maybe not. Maybe it's someone in between that. But basically, you run up and attack what looks like this just giant skeleton. It comes to life, gets shot with ethereal arrows, then pulls back into a mech that proceeds to fire a giant laser beam at you. It is the coolest thing I've ever seen. So it's kind of a, you know, not a lot to say about it other than, man, like, go look up some images of Sundered. It will make your day better.
Yeah, this is ridiculous.
It is so cool. Yeah.
The closest like referent for this that I can think of is if anybody saw the animated music videos that were done for Queens of the Stone Age's like Clockwork, that album, specifically for like My God Is the Sun or I Appear Missing, this like incredibly lush hand drawn art style. I would not have expected this to be I would not have expected this to lend itself to a procedural animation, like, oh, we need this to interact with gameplay kind of thing at all. But holy shit.
Yeah, at least in what they're showing, they've made it work. So that's cool. Jala, mm-hmm. I can't remember specifically how much you talked about the actual mechanics of the game. It sounds like you had an anecdote, so.
I did have an anecdote, but about the mechanics, it's a Metroidvania type. There are some fixed levels, but there's also, you know, procedurally generated levels. You can basically choose to take the corruption, you know, like the corrupted powers from these basically demonic totems or whatever throughout these caverns that you're going through, which power you up, but they start corrupting you and you lose your humanity. And I guess that does stuff to the story, I would assume. And you can either do that or you can decide not to take them, and then you don't get those powers, you know, and then you have to go through and it's harder to do, I would assume. The way that the dev was talking about it, it made it sound as if the powers themselves that you get, they may be very strong, but they're kind of like, they function sort of like cursed weapons, like there's some kind of drawback to them. you know, like, I don't know if they sometimes backfire or if they do something random or what the deal is with that as they get corrupted and as, you know, your corruption level goes up. But I likened it a lot to the play style, like the visuals to an extent and the play style to an extent, reminiscent to me of Abyss Odyssey, because, you know, you're also in a cavern thing going down, trying to, you know, fight through all these procedurally generated levels and whatnot. So it looked a lot to me like that, which is good because I like that game. The anecdote, though, was just like the way that the dev interacted with me was, I was walking around with Tim, you know, listener Tim for all the M, and we happened to pass by, or we were passing by the booth, and we were going to stop at that booth when we got a little bit closer, but the dev saw me, and I had like a dress on that actually, you know, was low to where you could see my shoulders, therefore my shoulder tattoos, and he's like, I love your tattoos, that's really kind of like this game, and then he started like pitching game and the corruption and the whatever, because I've got for people who actually have not seen me on, you know, anything like a picture of me, I have basically an angel wing and then like a dragon wing on my shoulders, so mm-hmm. That's a thing, and that was just pretty funny, just the way that he drew my attention to him and then just started talking about the game. I mean, I was going to look at it anyway, but it's okay. But you know,
yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looked definitely looked good, and that's one of the games that I put on my list to watch for when it comes out. I think it has a Steam page already. I might be wrong on that.
It has a Steam page.
Then I wish listed it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll close it out by giving probably my favorite quote that I think sums up what I'm seeing of the game so well, coming from Rock Paper Shotgun, which is Metroidvania, yeah, Cthulhu Fatagen.
Nice. Yeah, no, that's that is ridiculous. The hand drawn animation on that, like, that is the direction that I really wanted 2D visuals to go. Like, mm-hmm. the sprite stuff is really good and great. And if you have the animation to back up something hand drawn like this, obviously cool. But like, you know, taking advantage of HD graphics to like do something really lush like this, I don't know. Like, man, if we didn't get like hung up on everything being 3D in the mid 90s. The ways that this could have improved.
A cold 4K.
Yeah.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and you answer it. Oftentimes this would be a letter segment, but we do things a little bit different around here. Jala, what is the question that you ask the nice people?
So media we consume has the capacity to shape and reshape our perspective. What game has helped define your life experience or caused you to reevaluate an aspect of your life or worldview? And Greg P., thank you for the question.
Yeah, and apropos to that, I will read Greg's answer to his own question, which is, it's hard for me to answer my own question, smiley face. I'd say there are a couple of examples that come to mind. Final Fantasy IV showed me how detailed and impressive a story in a role-playing game could be. Compared to early RPGs, both Western and Japanese, the story was front and center in Final Fantasy IV, and for its time, quite advanced and mature. I never looked at RPGs the same way, as I came to emphasize story over anything else, could forgive and ignore bad gameplay if the plot was good enough. Really, it's only been in recent years that I've started to shift away from that. Yeah, Final Fantasy IV was really big for me as well. It was kind of one of the first real story-based games that I played. It wasn't my first RPG. That was Super Mario RPG. But 4 was less of a cartoon comic book, even though it is like a crazy, melodramatic, very broad strokes kind of thing. Had characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good answer. Let's see, Jala, what does Stuart say?
Stuart says, I may have said this before. On my 10th birthday, I got Final Fantasy IX. My PlayStation was having some trouble, so I would just sit reading the manual while my dad tried to fix it. Freya's quote on the character page is, to be forgotten is worse than death. That changed me in a deep way, and I struggle sometimes with believing that if my actions aren't leaving a deep impact on the world, they aren't worth anything.
Interesting.
Yeah,
man, I miss instruction manuals. I was gonna say game guides, but I never was in the game guides. I miss instruction manuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, butterfly effect. There's a lot of things that happen, Stuart, where literally, like, I've had people that when I've had crises and things happen, which is unfortunately more regularly than I'd like, and people will come up to me and say, you know what? You know, your blog inspired me, and I've never met them. They've never said anything to me before. Mm-hmm. And they just drop that. Or, you know, your social media posts always make me so happy or whatever. And I just got all these random people who never say anything to me ever, who just came out of nowhere and said, you know what? You're awesome. You know, it's okay. You'll be all right. So, like, you have more of an impact on people than you probably realize.
Yeah.
So just think about that too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love you, Stuart.
take notice of the small ways that other people affect you, and eventually you'll probably come around to realizing it works both ways.
Yeah.
Anything else about that?
I think we're good.
Okay. Ben, what does Corbin say?
Corbin says, mine is probably Spec Ops The Line. It made me far more cynical and less gung-ho about war. Not every soldier is a hero, and very few causes are totally noble.
Yeah.
That's why I made that the picture for the post. Spec Ops. That's a Spec Ops picture, although I haven't played the game and it's in my backlog, but I know.
Yeah.
I feel like it's the apocalypse now of video games.
Yeah.
Well, right now is not the time for me to be playing that, okay? I have too many things going on to deal with that.
Yeah, you have to kind of gird yourself for that. Like it's a short game, but it is an incredibly bitter pill, subject matter wise.
It can be the
apocalypse later for you, Jala.
Damn it. I was pleasantly, not pleasantly, man, what's the right way to say? I went into the game not having my life, you know, in dire straits around me. But I was very happy in retrospect that I was surprised by the mm-hmm. theming of it. Like, I did not go in knowing that it was going to be the way it was. And I think that was part of why it was so impactful for me.
Yeah. It was weird because, like, I was already receptive to the message, right? Mm-hmm. But how well it was articulated made me feel it or understand it in a different way, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep, good answer. Dennis, what does John say?
He says, this is a stock answer for me. See my nom de slack. But my answer is Final Fantasy VIII. I connected quite a bit with Squall, despite his over-the-top mopiness, particularly with his habit of carrying personal burdens internally and not reaching out for support or help. I saw a lot of myself there, and it continues to resonate with me. Yes, ultimately the day is won by the power of friendship, trademark, and love, which is corny as hell, but to be truthful, having a support network of people you can trust and with whom you can be vulnerable is vital to making one's way through the world. I won't go as far as to give the game credit for that realization, but it did make me more aware of my own struggles with self-imposed social isolation.
Yeah.
Yeah, the power of friendship and love thing is kind of a pervasive theme for any kind of shonen media from Japan. But my answer to this question, which I'll get to later, is also one that has kind of that similar feeling of you know, having that support network or whatever. So, yeah. And it's... I wouldn't say that it's uncommon to have that kind of realization about, you know what, this character is kind of like me, and oh, you know, there's, you know, oh man, you know, like,
yeah.
So that's not to, like, you know, trivialize this. It's not at all. It's just, this is the particular medium, you know, vector that, you know, conveyed that to him.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean,
very awesome.
Like, no matter how cliche it is, somebody gets exposed to it for the first time, you know, all the time, you know, like, something is always going to be somebody's first. And, like, I really want to go back and play Final Fantasy VIII because I like that game an awful lot. And, like, yeah, Squall is not meant to be like that aspect of him being the James Dean, like, loner. That's not meant to be looked up to. Like, it hurts people around him. It makes him genuinely unhappy, you know, and, like, his growth away from that, it's pretty important for that story. So, like, you're right to be annoyed by that particular presentation of him at the start.
Well, and fun fact, I have a ring that I never take off that is of the Lionheart. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, I had that. Cool. After I had a long relationship breakup, mm-hmm. I replaced the ring that I had from that with this ring, mm-hmm. and it was kind of like my remembrance of trying to remain open and not, like, letting everything crush me, stay strong, all of that stuff. So yeah. I don't ever take it off. I always have it on, except for when I absolutely have to take it off for some reason, like there's a metal detector kind of situation, but then it comes right back on again. Yeah, or surgery or something. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
It speaks to the, you know, the power of video games. Like, you know, that's a very fundamental thing of why we resonate with characters, is they're a mirror for ourselves in ways. But video games have the unique property where you're literally playing as that character, making, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. making it hit home that much more.
Yeah.
Yep.
Final Fantasy VIII, a good game. OMGamoose says, System Shock 2 taught me that I was a pathetic creature of meat and bone. Fortunately, renowned skeleton enthusiasts such as Gary Butterfield taught me that being a skeleton is awesome, and the level taught me that my meat is okay too if I stick it in a wall first.
Yay!
Wait, we endorse this?
Yeah, did we endorse glory holism? Is that a thing we've done?
No, wall meat. Wall meat. Oh, we had this conversation about wall meat, the there Castlevania types.
Yeah.
Jury's out on glory holism.
We've had a long and checkered past at the level.
I can't keep like all that stuff with Milo. Obviously, or hopefully, I've never said anything as hateful as that man has ever said. But like the fact that like something he said on a podcast took him down made me do like a weird little Saw montage cut. Like, oh God, if somebody took anything I said, not even out of context, just presented it, would it ruin my life the way that it kind of rightfully did for him? In my personal opinion, I don't know why I'm hedging around that, but that's
absolutely ruined his life.
Yeah, absolutely ruined his life.
Absolutely great that happened.
yeah. There we go. I'm not feeling particularly controversial today, even though yeah, fuck that guy. but just kind of thinking like, oh, there's so many hours of tape of just me saying asinine things.
It's the internet, man. There's that for everyone. It's just, it's one of those things where, yeah, you might be 1,000% higher than most people because of podcasting, but when everyone's at infinity to start with, doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah, it's this weird like mutually assured humiliation.
Oh man, mutually assured humiliation is a title contender.
I wrote it down just in case. I was kind of proud of it, although I don't like doing that.
That's good.
Jala, what does Ollie say?
Ollie says, Tomb Raider. I played it when I was 14 years old and playing sports at a high level. I was a typical jock type kid, full of my own self-importance, and I used to think girls were bad. That's an inelegant sentence that sums up my 14-year-old self's thought process. Enter Lara Croft. It's not an exaggeration to say that she was the first female character I'd played as, and it really opened my eyes to the fact that girls were just as good as boys. It might sound silly to think of now, but it really was a new experience for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend in the entertainment industry that talks about like, you know, I sometimes feel less than for just trying to put out content that depicts a diverse audience or whatever. When other people are out, like, you know, on the front lines or, you know, doing more active stuff, but taking a step back and realizing that, man, just seeing, you know, a diverse cast or a character that is a positive portrayal of a woman or, you know, any other minority really does have power. So, I mean, you got to have that realization sometime. 14 years old is a lot earlier than a lot of people have it.
Yeah, some people never have it at all.
Yeah.
It validates the reason that you do that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
That why it's so important to put diverse characters into the mediums that we experience.
I mean, representation counts.
Mm-hmm. I like the way Naughty Dog does it, where like after they have like their story and all their characters and stuff, they'll go back and analyze like, okay, why does this character need to be either this gender or this race or whatever? Like, mm-hmm. is there anything inherent about their character? And if not, let's make it what we want to make it. You know, like it can be anything.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Pretty great.
Yes.
Good.
When I was little, I've talked about this before on the podcast, but I always had a big struggle trying to find any media that would portray a strong female character that didn't eventually have to, like, defer to a man or be saved by a man, not because, like, you know, she just needs help from a bro, but, like, because she's the girl who has to defer to her new boyfriend or some crap, you know? And,
Metroid?
Like, all of the characters... Yeah, I know, Metroid, but, like, you don't even find out until she's a girl until the very end of the game, and then, mm-hmm. like, you know, whatever. But, like, and then they sexify her later on anyway, but whatever. So, but, like, it was just difficult, and, you know, growing up and having to deal with that, I'm just like, ugh. Mm-hmm. Damn.
Yeah. And like Tomb Raider's presentation of Lara Croft, I can think of two major problems with the way that she's depicted, but even still, like it was a big positive.
Two major problems, the left and the right.
Yeah.
I was gonna rip a little on too a subtle. Big positive, but
we're doing Tomb Raider for Watch Out for Fireballs, actually. Allison,
okay,
cool. It's our first executive produced episode. Allison has requested that, and I'm very excited because we haven't done that, and that is a pretty big blind spot for us. So I'm excited to go back and do original OG, probably the same Tomb Raider that Ollie played. So
yeah,
nice.
Big thumbs up.
Oh,
on that.
What fun fact! I went to a convention because I dress however I like, and this has been talked about on the PAX episode. But I went to a convention and I happened to be this is around the time, this is years, the 90s, late 90s, and after whichever Tomb Raider it was where Lara Croft had the skin dive suit and everything. And I happen to have a crop top that looked like that. And then I was wearing black shorts and I had my hair in a braid and I have brown hair and I had sunglasses. And so people thought I was dressed as Lara Croft. And I'm like, no, I'm just being me. And people were taking pictures of me and stuff. So
accidental cosplay.
Yeah. Accidental cosplay. So yeah, that's a thing.
You say I'm not cosplaying Lara Croft. She's cosplaying me.
Yep. All right. Ben, what does Sam say?
Sam says, I make liberal use of the hide all from this page command and applied uBlock origin filters. Goodbye, goodbye, Facebook trending sidebar, to make sure that little to no links to news sites appear on Facebook, regardless of authenticity or political position. After watching a Men Drinking Coffee LP of Watch Dogs 2 made me paranoid about social media as a form of mind control. This is not a joke.
No, it's not. It's actually pretty fucking serious and scary.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
The common response or the common thing to invoke is say, it's like a Black Mirror episode, right, guys? Right? It's like, no, it's like fucking real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I forget which outlet did it. Maybe Slate, but presented what this goes a little bit against what Sam was saying, but presented conservative Facebook and liberal Facebook and showed just how different they were. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is kind of interesting how powerful algorithms are, just computer decisions are, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of things that were a mess about Zuckerberg's kind of weird 5,700 word kind of pseudo political essay talking about Facebook's role in democracy. I have absolutely no trust in algorithms. It's been pooched so bad so far.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we don't need a hyper intelligent Skynet to take down humanity. We just need a poorly programmed algorithm.
Yeah,
or one that's programmed too well.
Yeah,
I mean, as long as it's open source, I have no problems with it. As long as everyone can see what it's doing. But yeah, I don't like spooky secret algorithms.
No. And but that is in some cases for a lot of these companies, the algorithm is the core of their trade secret. It's I'm not a fan. And the more I read about these stories specifically for my job, It makes me pretty scared. So Sam, I think that you're onto something. That is pretty recent in terms of the revelations that we've seen, especially compared to what a lot of people came to very early in life. Mm-hmm. But yeah, even if something as crazy as Watch Dogs will do that.
All the more reason to get out and talk to humans in real life, people. So yeah. Valuable.
Dennis, what does David say?
He says, The Dark Souls 2 release taught me how far I could shove my head in the sand and still absorb unwanted media. Hey, this kind of compliments Sam's. I was getting it for PC, and it came out a month after consoles. It had been hard enough blocking out pre-release info, but after it was all but impossible. Luckily, the bits I gleaned were boss and some area names that didn't ultimately spoil much. Going on a month hiatus from Bonfireside Chat and muting so many good people on Twitter was the worst.
Yeah, you just went on a temporary fast. This wasn't so much a new revelation. You just learned a new habit.
Yeah, by the way, you were one day off of enlightenment, and then the game came out. So you were so close. Yeah. You didn't realize it. That's what happens.
Yeah, it's always harder the second time too. yeah. Christopher writes, Planescape Torment. That game's a damn philosophy simulator. Yeah,
good answer.
It's it is an introduction to a couple of existential concepts and nihilistic concepts. Planescape is a fascinating setting just because of the mechanics for existence that they lay out, but specifically related to morality and individuals' past and the roots of humanity. There are some pretty cool concepts they get across. Your mileage may vary. I think they handle it pretty. pretty subtly, you know. Mm-hmm. Artfully. Yeah. Artfully. There we go. There's some things about the game that are just not subtle at all, but they're handled artfully. Very cool. Jala, what does Jason say?
Jason says, sometimes you reach a point in life when the monotony becomes too great and you need to make a change. Working at the headquarters of a giant, greedy soda corporation, I needed just that. I left the trappings of my busy life for a simpler one, making an honest living in my grandpa's old farm. I learned that everyone is entitled to the sweat on their brow and all the satisfaction that comes with it. The game that taught me this, Stardew Valley.
Tongue sticking out, smiley emoticon.
Yeah. That's good. That's pretty good.
I need to buckle down and play Stardew Valley, because people who talk about it in such glowing terms, and like
they do, and I don't understand what it is.
it's independent Harvest Moon. It's indie game Harvest Moon.
I don't understand what that is.
It's a farming simulator, like a farming
simulator. It's a relaxation simulator.
It's like a simple rural living simulator. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate, Ben? Because it's not just farming.
You do chores, and it's like in a happy environment, so it doesn't feel like chores.
Oh, that's some Second Life shit right there.
A little.
No, I mean, I get the appeal and everything. It's those games have always been, or felt nebulous to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I get too invested.
Yeah, don't feel crazy. Not everything's for everybody. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They have a haunted house in the game. It's just lovely.
that makes it for cold.
Yeah.
Jala, I would totally look at the house and then I would stop playing the game. And that would be the end of it.
And Ben, round us out with Jonathan.
Jonathan says, Fallout 3D games. There's been a lot said about the story and writing in those games, usually negative comments. I've recently gone through old crops like Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 and Fallout 2 and realized they weren't that well written. Retroactively ruining games.
Huh. I'd be curious what specifically you pulled away from the 3D games as opposed to like in addition to kind of understanding that just because something new is seen by fans of the thing to not be as good as the old thing, that the old thing probably wasn't that great to begin with. I phrase that so ineloquently. Guys,
there's probably at least two double negatives in there.
Yeah. So what did you pull away from that aside from old things are not good just by virtue of being old? That there is possibly some refinement that takes place that someone from outside the kind of nostalgia cycle would appreciate without that baggage.
Yeah, I can see that.
Try two. Yes, nailed it, guys. Stuck the landing. Oh man. Thank you everybody for writing in. Let us do ours. Jala, I'm curious. I'm curious to hear what you have to say.
Well, it shouldn't be a surprise that I'm gonna say that the first thing that really grabbed my attention and affected me in a dramatic way was Lunar on Sega CD. Yeah. I specify Sega CD because the PlayStation versions of the games, especially the first game, got overhauled. I mean, the second game on PlayStation, the remake, the Lunar Eternal Blue Complete, was pretty much, you know, like very, very close to the original. But the first game got totally overhauled, and then it got super preachy in the PlayStation version. And it wasn't like that in the Sega CD version. Hmm. So anyway, It irritated me. Aspects of it irritated me when I played it on the PlayStation, but I didn't on the original Sega CD version. So bear that in mind, like for the people who have played the PlayStation version. It has the usual spin of Power of Friendship kind of theme, but it is a little bit altered to Power of Humanity instead. not, you know, you and your bros, and that's how you power up to fight the end boss, so much as like, you know, I mean, there's parts in the game where that kind of thing happens, but it's, you know, the power within each individual person. And when I got to the end of the first game, defeated Galleon, and saw Alex standing in front of Luna, who was, you know, his girlfriend, basically, who was reawakened as the goddess Althina and, you know, basically cannot be a human anymore. And they're split apart forever. Like, for this game that's like from 95.
Yeah.
So anyway, when that happened, little kid Jala didn't think there was a way that could make things work out, and it didn't really sink in as to the magnitude of Luna Alfina's choice to become a human again and allow herself to die, and then there's no goddess anymore. That didn't really sink in until I played the second game and saw the world without the goddess. There's a, you know, a fake goddess in play, you know, that's a puppet for like a dark god, and you know, all this other stuff going on. And then when the villain from the first game returns in the second game and double crosses the antagonist to kind of, you know, help out the humans that, you know, the goddess believed in so much, made me cry all over again. Like, I cried so much. This game meant so much to me, and I just had such a strong reaction to it and attached to the characters. And it was a game I played at a time in my life that was really rough, and it was just positive and kind of kept the feeling of hope alive for me when I was, you know, feeling pretty rough. And we were moving around a lot. I didn't know where my sister was at the time. She just had moved out, and we didn't know where she was. And we didn't have a place to live. We were living with my grandmother, who had Alzheimer's and all different kinds of stuff. It was real rough. And, you know, the major thing that these games did was basically make me feel like perhaps there is such strong faith to be had out in the world somewhere, mm-hmm. A trust that can in fact be warranted, a bond that is strong enough to withstand anything. Mm-hmm. I have always been by nature like a romantic optimist, but time simultaneously has shaped me into a realist that has been hurt so much by people in situations that, although I still have that pure and hopeful core, it's covered in scars that haven't healed fully, but that core is still there, in part, I would think, because of this game, you know, being there and being something that I return to pretty regularly. So,
yeah.
Yep.
It's good stuff right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I have anything to add or questions to ask or follow up for that. Yeah. No. Thank you for sharing so much.
Yeah.
Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I need to dig a layer deeper on mine now. but no, so mine is Roller Coaster Tycoon. And it's because that's when I realized that I could just kill people that were inconvenient to me, and that solves my problems.
Okay.
Oh, okay, all right.
That's pretty deep, Dennis. I don't know.
That's the type of endorsements that I was talking about before.
No, seriously, Roller Coaster Tycoon was the game where I realized that what the game tells you to do and how you have fun with the game aren't necessarily the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I played through it, or through a significant portion of it, kind of every park I'd open up, and it had its objective, and I had to design it. I always optimized the ride for, you know, the to get the best scores and all this stuff. And then when I, you know, realized, oh, I can turn on God mode and have unlimited money and build wicked, crazy, awesome roller coasters, that is so much more fun, and like was just way, way more entertaining to me. And of course, everything I built made anyone who ride it puke their guts out. Like, of course. But that, you know, that's not the point. That's being creative and doing this thing that you think is cool. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know if I can claim that had too much of, you know, unlocked too much for me in life outside of video games. But that's the first time I can remember making that distinction of like, hey, this is kind of, I want to have fun with this a different way than is laid out in the quote unquote rules. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Very cool. Ben, how about you?
All right. I got a couple different categories. The just changing your perspective, like mind bendy, you could say Portal or Bioshock Infinite, where they just kind of like expand your thinking of like, I don't know, physics or science or whatever. But then probably more to the point of this question, games that have made you kind of change how you think in terms of like empathetic standards. Walking Dead and Last of Us kind of gave you a picture into what like parenting might be like, or like caring for somebody who might need help, I guess more so with Walking Dead and then instead of Last of Us.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the game Life is Strange did a good job of giving me a perspective of a character that I had not had a lot of experience with in terms of giving you role playing as like a high school girl. And then I was going to throw in Journey as one of giving you a perspective on what death is like, or like losing your abilities. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I like how you phrased it. I like how you phrased it, where it's like giving you, not giving like Ben, giving someone else who is not Ben these feelings. Like
that's a layer of remove.
Yeah.
The idea of like losing your abilities is so interesting. I haven't gone back and played 2 Ash now that it's out yet, but that seemed to me to have a very similar arc. And I don't know if I would have made that connection to Journey unless you had said that just now, Ben. But yeah. I bet those games share a lot of DNA beyond just the sections where you lose abilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My answer is not going to surprise anybody. Silent Hill 2. You know, a lot of the stuff that's in there is not necessarily new. They have very clear, a very clear stable of references that they are making, both visual and thematically. But it was my first exposure to a lot of those, that particular type of psychological narrative, that particular kind of portrayal, not just of, you know, mental health issues, but also just kind of very human stories about the ways that people can kind of carry things around and how much that can hurt them if it goes unexamined. You know, I played this game shortly after it came out, so I was probably like 15 or so, and so I think I was ready for that kind of level of sophistication. And even if I haven't taken away like a huge empathetic or kind of moral, you know, take away aside from like, oh man, like these are tremendous characters and it's a very powerful story that it's, you know, that's at the core of this, you know, Rust monsters aside. It has definitely informed or helped me find a great deal of kind of trends in media or kinds of art that I, you know, really enjoy. Like it kind of established a taste for me and, you know, probably set me on whatever course of decisions that led to this, which is such a huge and important part of my life.
For sure.
Yeah.
Good question, Jala.
Yeah. Well, good question, for a good pick of question, and also good question.
Oh,
Greg.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I rephrased it a little bit, but it was Greg's idea. So yeah.
Question Greg.
Well, thank you everybody for sharing, these kind of personal stories. If you want to participate in these in the future, we can't guarantee that all of them are going to be breakthroughs like this. But follow us on Facebook. We are facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. And these questions go up Tuesday afternoon or early evening. Thanks to both Jala and Dennis.
The grind.
Now it is time for the grind, where we talk about the games we've been playing over the past period of time or so. Because we have the same crew that we had last episode, I don't know who to send in first. So, Jala, I'm going to defer to you.
Okay. So, first thing is my co-op corner. So, I played Guild Wars 2 with Greg, who was the one who did the question. So, woo! He's lots of name drop in this episode. He hadn't played this game before. He asked me to play it with him since, you know, I was the Guild Wars 2 person, you know, for a bit there in prior episodes. And he made a human guardian. Rather than rolling around with my main character in the starter areas, which is really boring for, you know, a high-level character to do, I used a fresh Lobi character that I created and literally just played the intro bit with. She's a human revenant, which is a new class that was added during the Heart of Thorns expansion, and I haven't, you know, obviously I hadn't played it. She was, like, level 2. So, anyway, I took him to go fight a big zone boss, the Shadow Behemoth of God's Lost Swamp. And then we started just exploring the map. And when we left off, we popped into town to drop stuff off at the bank. And I believe the next time we play, we're going to be exploring Divinity's Reach, which is the human city. It's huge. And you get XP for doing so, like going around and 100%ing the map. And so we'll need the waypoints for the personal stories anyway, for the quests. But anyway, I like running around in the city because it's non-combat zones, but they're really pretty. There's a lot to explore, and basically there are vistas, which are basically points where you can go and take a look at, you know, a portion of this area you've been running around in. And it's basically the, you know, ArenaNet just showing off the game and showing off the environments that they've made. And
the
lot of them are kind of
from Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, well, and then too, like, it's oftentimes some weird jumping puzzle that you have to figure out to get a lot of them. So I like trying to figure out, how the hell do I get to it? It's up there. How do I get to it? You know, like, that's fun for me. And it's been long enough since I went to Divinity's Reach and wandered around that it's going to be like playing it all over again, like from scratch. So about the Revenant, though, in the original Guild Wars, there was an assassin class. They did not translate that over directly in Guild Wars 2. What they did is kind of reincarnate it, where most of the moves went into the thief class, but then a lesser extent to the Revenant. And I say that because the Revenant is a soldier profession that has, like, you know, heavy armor and, you know, carries heavy weapons and, you know, smashes stuff in a close area, but warps around and has, like, get over here kind of moves and stuff like that, which are pretty assassin-ish. So pretty neat. And you can dual wield maces or swords, or, you know, a mace and a sword, or a staff, or whatever, a hammer, all different kinds of stuff. They also have stances based on the original heroes and villains from the first game, which is pretty neat. That's kind of a warrior trait to have stances. So
yeah.
I don't normally play melee anything in Guild Wars. It's not my forte, so this is a challenge for me to play this character. But
what are some of the stances?
Well, the one I've got on currently is a dwarf stance, which is based on a character from the first game, but they have like an assassin stance.
You take your shoes off and you put them on your knees.
No, they have different effects. Like, I want to say the dwarf one ends up like freezing enemies or something, like at after a certain point. I don't know. There's like there's different status effects that happen depending upon what stance you take.
Okay.
And they give you buffs or effects to, you know, your attacks. So, yeah, they're pretty cool. But, yeah, so I've been playing Guild Wars 2. Nothing else to say about that just so yet, you know, just so far. If I get sick of playing a melee character, I'll just swap. I've got a million characters, and they've all been to the starter area of the humans. So it's not a big deal to mosey over.
Right.
The next thing I've been playing in co-op, the other thing I've been playing in co-op is Vermintide. Dennis finally got me to play when he was, like, still drunk off his ass. Yay!
I can't believe it took as much doing as it did.
Well, that's...
just got your defenses down.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is that, like, the problem is that when you're available, Dennis, is usually when I'm, like, done with my training, I took a shower, I have been sitting in bed relaxing for a while, and I'm up, but I'm down. I'm not going to get up and go march through the backyard to go to my office, which is where my computer is. Like, if my computer was in the house, that would be one thing. But this is not another room of the house. This is, like, outside over there, and I have to go get my key and then fumble around in the dark to unlock the door and whatever, and I don't want to deal with it. So that's why it took so long, is because, like, the time that you ask me, it's like, okay, no, I'm not going to go out there. I am very comfortable right now. So, but you caught me at a time, and we got to play 2 days in a row, in fact.
Yeah.
I'm so proud. Yeah, that was a record. So I played with Dennis, and then I played with Sam and Conrad during the day at some point, and then I played with Dennis and David. So I played a few sessions. So
and this
I played
is
the
Warhammer Left 4 Dead, but with rats, were-rats specifically.
This is fucking Lord of the Rings is what it is, because, like, I was playing the archer person, the Waywatcher, and Dennis, for the bulk of the time, was playing the dwarf guy. And so, you know, like, I was Legolas, for reals, and I was doing pretty good damage. Like, okay, Dennis is level 17, I'm level 3. I'm with the starter bow, and I had the highest damage. So you just need to let me have, you know, a sniping character and leave me alone. And I said that before when I was talking about PAX, because I punked a lot of kids who were playing some shooty game, Earthfall, with me. And yeah, that's Left 4 Dead, but aliens.
So. Yeah, you were kicking ass and taking names.
I like the thing. Well, anyway, so some notes about the game from my perspective. Well, first off, the archery felt really satisfying. It sounds right. It feels good to play. It's you know, awesome. And that's amazing, because it's very hard, I think, for people to get archery right in a game. Like, it just almost never works right or feels right. But this one, it's awesome. I really enjoy it.
Have you played Probably Archery, Jala?
No.
I should gift you a copy of this. It's like Surgeon Simulator or Quap, but for archery. or like receiver. It's actually pretty funny. Sorry, you just made a monkey's paw wish. So. Continue.
Well, during one of the missions, there was a huge horn that was like the size of a building that had to be blown for, I don't know what reason, but for some important reason, it needed to be, you know, sounded. And when it did, it felt really satisfying again. Like, the sound design in the game was really awesome. And it just kind of felt legit a lot of times when the rat hordes were coming in, like, oh shit, everything's overrun, the horde, oh, you know, like, it was pretty cool. So, yeah, and the controls are so much like Left 4 Dead that I didn't have a problem picking it up and immediately playing without my slow learning curve that I usually have. So, that's cool. And the graphics are better than I expected, but I don't know what I was expecting exactly. I don't know why I didn't expect them to have good graphics, but I really didn't. So, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe because it's like a triple B game, you know?
Well, and then also I have to say, David and I are probably going to have some fights if we end up playing together a lot, because like, he likes the Waywatcher also. And, he was nice enough to let me play the Waywatcher and then just, you know, sidle over to the soldier. Partially because I was like, well, when we were playing Gauntlet, I let you have the archer and I took the Valkyrie. So, I don't have any interest really in playing anybody else. Like, I would usually gravitate towards the sorceress lady, but I don't have any interest in playing her. I'm like, I'm sure she plays fine. I'm sure she's fun, but I like the archer, and I don't know, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, as that long kinda... as you don't take her, anybody else who has it can play with me.
Is it the case that two people cannot pick the same class, or is it the case that a team with multiple of the same class will not be as successful?
No, you cannot pick the same class. Okay. Each person can pick one of the characters, and that's it. Hmm. So
yeah. Is it a four-person party, or?
Is it four-person, right?
Yep, it is four-person. And I think you've got six characters to choose from.
Yeah, yeah. And also, the game really wants me to play the sorceress, because I dumped a bunch of stuff into this, you know, like, exchange your items for better ones thing, and then I kept getting I got a staff, really, you know, my best weapon right now is a staff, which is used by the sorceress lady, and every single time I kept on getting stuff, it was like staff, like I even put on the trinket for the Waywatcher so I would get, you know, the stuff for my archer character, but no, it's just all for her. I don't know,
it's meant
whatever.
To be.
Yes. So anyway, that's all I have to say about Vermintide so far. I know like 20 people in my friends list have this game, so
we can play the game. Humble Monthly, man.
Yeah.
Okay, that's why so many people have it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we should do the thing. As long as you don't play the archer and as long as you don't ping me in bed.
Please ping me to play this game, because the matchmaking is horrible. You almost always have to be starting up with a friend, or you will not find a party, which is super annoying. I'm not to the point where I'm always picking a specific mission, versus I know there's an option to just hit like any mission and start searching for a party. Maybe that works a lot better. But I definitely have had trouble connecting to any kind of random party. So
yeah,
ping us. We'll play.
Yeah. Okay, so next thing. I've been playing more Steins Gate. I played and played and played, and I got my Yuri's ending, finally. And then I started all over from the beginning, I'm about at chapter 4, I think.
Mayuri being the hyper... the hyper, I'm gonna say cute, but like, that's not like a quality of judgment thing. Like, she's the primary female lead, aside from Karisu, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That one.
Yeah.
With the hat.
With the hat, there we go, with the hat and the umbrella, yeah.
Yeah. So, although it doesn't bother me too much because there's a fast forward button, the mechanic of having to go through all the crap you did before over and over again doesn't make any sense to me, because I bet most people skip through it. So it's just a mechanical hassle to get to the parts where you actually need to make decisions. So in this way, Cole, here's something groundbreaking. I actually prefer the sort of flowchart thing that Zero Escape has, because at least you can backtrack to the point where you make the fucking decision and then you move on with life.
Yeah, so you're not just sitting there watching the background cycle.
Yeah, and like, it's not so annoying that I just want to stab somebody in the eye, but it is like, I'm betting by the time I'm done playing this, I'm gonna be like, okay, I'm so done. Hopefully I don't have to start from the beginning every single time, but I don't know. If I do, I'm gonna get upset.
Yeah.
So I'm saving profusely in all the different spots where it looks like there's gonna be decisions to be made, so yeah, maybe I can just back my save files.
The only kind of tricky one is Carissa's ending. That is the one that you're going to need a flowchart or a guide for, to make sure you do the right text messages. That's like the golden ending or the true ending. I don't know what the visual novel people call it.
Well, the thing about this game, though, that the part of the reason it doesn't bother me so much is because what is of significance is a bunch of random things in stuff that you don't necessarily think, like those text messages, like you email back and forth on your phone, and sometimes those are like the key to unlocking the next thing. And, you know, some of them are small and don't really do much other than give you achievements. And then some of them are big deals, but it's like a stupid message that, you know, again, butterfly effect, kind of like changes everything, you know, and it's stupid, but it's not stupid because like, that's a thing that legit changes outcomes and everything, and I guess in a way the game is trying to teach you that.
It's so I don't want to pull the drawstring on that too much. That'll affect like certain scenes that you see, but pretty much every ending aside from Mayuri's, which you get just by playing the game, and Karisu's, which requires you to respond to certain things correctly, is just like at the end of a chapter, it'll say, do you want to undo what you've done, or do you want to continue living with this person? So like with Luca's chapter, you know, like, do you go back and change things around so you can, you know, keep her the way that she is? You know, like that is something that you're going to run across no matter what.
Okay. Well, then that's cool. Cause like, I was going to say, man, the ways that could parse out if all of these emails are like groundbreaking and some of them that seem inconsequential actually have these dramatic effects and whatever. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a pain if every single one of these storylines is tied to all of these little, like, oh my God, I will never understand. I will never get the endings of this game.
Yeah. If they do affect something, most of the time it is like showing you an incidental scene related to that particular character.
Okay. Well, that's cool. That's at least a little bit less vexing anyway. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I'm not actually vexed by it. Like I've played other visual novels before. I know that's a thing, but you know, it's just that this game, I think the reason why it bothers me is because there are so many messages that come up that you have to reply to if you want to get, you know, certain scenes to pop or whatever, that, you know, you have to stop, but it doesn't, like, when you get an email, the game doesn't stop scrolling. It keeps scrolling, and you have to be like, oh, whoa, oh, fuck, now I have to reload.
You're playing it on auto. Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, I sped it forward with the button, the shoulder button.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah. So... But then I have to, like, if I'm holding it like claw finger, you know, like, oh my God, this is so much exposition. And then suddenly I get an email that I have to reply to. Oh, I missed it. Oh, now I got to do it again.
Yeah.
That gets irritating. Like, I wish it stopped or gave you, like, a way to, you know, slow it down just enough so you could get that email real quick and then move on. But
yeah,
it's a niggly thing. I'm still enjoying the story. I like what it's doing. It's cool. So, yeah.
Well,
nothing else to say about that without revealing information about the game that would spoil it. So
I'm surprised that you have stuck with it that long. Pleasantly so, based on your initial impressions.
Well, I had said even in the beginning, like, okay, the Daru is making me mad, but
and
the exposition is dragging its ass. But like, there are things about this game that I like, and I'm really thinking that I'm going to like it once it gets going. You know, and sure enough, I do. So.
Yeah.
So cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
Into it.
I did one more thing.
Okay.
And I played The Inner World. I talked about it during the PAX South recap. It's available on Steam, iOS, and Android. It is a point-and-click adventure game with hand-drawn cartoon aesthetics. And the world setup is like so. You live in Asposia, which is a tiny world inside the soil. And once upon a time, there were sacred winds which blew from the wind fountains that brought light, warmth, and life to the Asposians. And suddenly, two out of the three wind fountains died out. There's only one left, and the abbot Conroy happens to be guarding it. And there are these creatures called Basilians who are called wind gods and who turn people to stone with their gaze. And everybody says the wind gods are mad, and that's why the wind fountains are, you know, busted down and stuff. And you play as Robert, who is basically a little dude who lives in the monastery and was more or less adopted by Conroy. And he's only ever lived in the monastery, and he doesn't know what the outside world is like at all, to the point that he doesn't know about money, alcohol, anything. And so his interactions with the world are hilarious because he makes these observations and has these statements or viewpoints that are fresh and entertaining, but they're not like nothing in this game, although it makes social commentary and things like that, it's not presented in a way that feels like depressing or bitter or anything like that. Like, it's just amusing, and then you move on with your life, you know? And like, when you first get out of the monastery, you come across a garbage dealer in a back alley, and he's like, "Do you want some garbage?" "I don't have any." "Oh, what do you mean garbage? I don't have any garbage." "What are you talking about, garbage? Do you need some garbage here?" And he just has like junk that nobody wants, like knickknacks and crap. And he's a garbage dealer trying to, like, you know, sneak. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
And anyway, like, the game has a lot of eccentric and memorable characters, and the, like I said, the writing is very witty, and the voice acting is so on point that it's just so much fun to listen to these characters talking to each other. It's funny as hell. As it's an adventure game, it has puzzles, but they're neither too difficult nor too easy, so that's awesome. I'm about 3/5 of the way done right at the moment. I'm on chapter 4 of 5 right now. And I highly recommend this game. It's got a lot of charm. It makes some amusing commentary without becoming dark, like I said. And I've been posting all these different, you know, like screenshots of different little instances of some of the amusing stuff that's happened to my Instagram and therefore to Facebook and Twitter. Like, you come across a Cinemat, which is a mechanical device where you go to confess your sins. And it says it's Cinemat, for the sinner on the go, confession and absolution in less than a minute. And it, like, you go up to it and it says, "Tell me your sin." And then if you say, like, Robert's like, "I don't even know. Like, I just came out of the monastery. Tell me your sin." And then, like, he finally is like, "Well, I talked to a lot of people and maybe I bothered them. Sacrifice a mint to the Basilians," and then it just gives you a mint. Like, and he's like, "What? What? How does sacrificing a mint have anything to do with making those people feel better?"
Mm-hmm. Like, so it's basically how confession works, you know?
Well, and then he goes into a bar and the bartender is like, "Do you want a jawbreaker? What's that? How about a mind blower?" And, you know, Robert's like, and she's like, "It's a liqueur. It's the specialty of the house." And Robert's like, "Those all seem really violent." And then she's like, "Here, have one. Give it a shot." And, she, you know, he's like, I'll drink this if I want to die." And, like, it's pretty great. And so, like, there was a dude gambling. Saturday night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then he's like, he sees a dude gambling and he's like, "Let me see how this works. You put money in and pull the lever again and again and again." It's like, yeah, that's pretty much it, you know. You come across a tailor, and, like, the tailor is in prison, has been imprisoned by Conroy for her own protection. And this tailor has really massive arms that are sticking out, like, hanging out the window. And so Robert's like, "Oh, my gosh, you know, you look like you could, you know, wield a sledgehammer. Why would you want to be a tailor, you know?" And then she's like, "You sound like my father. My parents wanted me to be a bouncer, but my love of yarn started early." And then she just like goes on, like, I started with cotton, but then I got into the harder fabrics, and just like talking about it like the seedy underworld of knitting or something. And it's just so funny.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's kind of like the way that this game rolls. It's just, it makes these comments that are just funny as hell. And it's just a lot of fun to play. It's really refreshing. I've been playing it on my phone in bed, so.
Yeah,
it's good.
Can I ask you a point of clarification? You're referring to something called explosions?
Explosions.
Okay, so this is a kind of people from inside this world. You're not just saying you're not just saying explosions like a Rugrat.
No.
Okay.
No, Asposia is the name of the country, and therefore explosions are the names of the people.
Okay. And explosions is what happens when Dee Dee leaves the pot on the stove and the Peschetti gets everywhere.
And explosions is a DVD you should not watch.
Yeah. What time?
We also had Dennis's Sunday morning.
I had in college on Victor Street had a neighbor who moved out. They're great. We did a lot of drinking on the porch, a lot of talking, a lot of breaking bottles, you know, just general wholesome stuff. When they moved out, there was a DVD on the lawn, and I assume it either fell out of a box or just, you know, was part of loose detritus. And the title of this DVD film was Ass, Ass, and Mo-Ass. this ended up being, like, passed around a lot. Nobody ever watched it, but it would just show up in somebody's room. Ass, ass, and by God, Mo-Ass. So. But
I like to think that it was the third in a trilogy. First was ass, the second was ass, ass, and the third was ass, ass, and mo ass.
But this, like, this is a recent game, right? Innerworld.
Actually, I want to say that it came out in 2012. The way that it rolled was this: I went to PAX and I was looking around, and Tim and I were poking around, and then I was like, "Tim, look at that banner for that game, The Innerworld." Ooh, mm-hmm. That looks interesting. Tim's like, yeah, that does look interesting. They were there to showcase the new game that they're working on, wherein you play some kind of slime creature, but I didn't pay much attention to it because I liked the way the inner world looked. And so we were looking at that and not paying attention to the new game. So that is sad to say, but I will confess that is what happened. But the game is proving to be well worth the time, and I totally recommend it. And I know that there are a lot of people who have seen my various screenshots that are like, I'm going to play this game. I've got to play this game now. So go look at it. It's cool.
I am among them. It is in my inventory now. So
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Is that all, Jala?
That's all.
Yeah. I'm going to do mine because you're going to be pretty brief. Been doing a lot of assignment play, getting, you know, just the, like, this weird mid off season for Bonfireside Chat has been a thing. But since the last time we spoke, Rocksmith has taken on a new kind of dimension for me, because just buying one new instrument was not enough. That crazy little Epiphone Les Paul. Dennis, you'll be happy to know I bought a bass.
Awesome. Yeah. Yay. I saw you tweeting about this.
Yeah. I got myself a, it is a Squire Jaguar, with like a transparent red finish. It is very handsome. I've only ever played a bass once before, and that was when you brought your bass over to again play Rocksmith, and I failed miserably on Go With The Flow. It's interesting. So I was curious about it. Like, again, you get that bee in your bonnet about something new, and so I wanted to try something new. I had wanted a bass for a while, but also I wanted to work on my rhythmic playing and also like work on my my right hand dexterity more so than a lot of other stuff, and that seemed like a good way to do it. And it's a lot of fun, like the way that Rocksmith handles bass lines and bass notation. Like, it's just baked right into the normal way they show you these notes, and they even do you like the courtesy of saying like, hey, this song is played with a pick, or this song is fingered, you know, so like you know how you're going to, you know, start approaching it. So either the way that they score you is way too lax, or coming to bass from guitar after you kind of get the ability to, you know, use your fingers on the strings and, you know, get used to just the fact that they're going to fucking wreck your hand because they are literally the diameter of telephone pole wires. Like I kind of got it. Like I know the boxes and the patterns and stuff just from knowing how to navigate a neck on a bass. So like I picked up what's the frequency, Kenneth, and like I nailed like a 95% on it. But like I worry that because they only check whether or not you have played a note successfully, they're not catching like the weird little like sloppiness in between. So like if I just sat down to play that line, it would sound like horse garbage. You know, because bass does require a certain amount of precision that, like, it is not testing you for.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's only doing a certain check for the right frequency versus... I can see that.
Versus actually checking, like, did you play an accidental note on the way to this other note? You know?
I think it's definitely the case that you pick up a lot more playing regular guitar and then going to bass than you do playing bass and then going to regular guitar. So I would not be surprised at all if a significant amount carried over from guitar to bass. I've heard some people who are way more experienced than I am say that there are some like quote unquote bad habits or like things that someone who just plays inherently bass will see about a guitarist playing bass. But I think that's once you're like super duper advanced and doesn't really affect your average person.
Yeah.
Who wants to try it?
Yeah, I don't. My intention isn't to like swing in like a carpetbagger and say, bass isn't so hard because it's incredibly difficult, you know. But like, it has been incredibly satisfying to like pick it up and say, like, oh, if I put my mind to it, I could just learn a new instrument specifically because, like, if you're playing a fretted bass, you just already know the scales. So,
yeah, and that's very much the case.
Yeah. So it's been a lot of fun. I've had gotten a great deal of enjoyment of like switching days between the bass and just regular guitar on Rocksmith, and kind of getting my mastery percentage up on those, and then running that bass through my guitar amp, which doesn't work that great, but just kind of fucking around with that has been pretty good as well.
So nice. When are you going to get a drum set now?
the second I get my own house. because
so Rocksmith 2015 comes out.
Yep, 2015. it's a little bit like car model years, except they're three behind.
Yeah. No, they'll get Rocksmith 2014 episode two.
But it's fun to like, you know, like with any of these music games, you want to reach a little bit above your, you know, like punch a little bit above your weight class. So like, I'll fire up No One Knows by Queens of the Stone Age, which is the most difficult, the most difficult rated song. And like, I fuck it up, but it kind of knows what notes to show me. And like, oh, here are the bones of this. And then figuring out how to fill it out is a good time. Mm-hmm. So Rocksmith, two thumbs up. It has been very fun to use that to supplement just my general fucking around on guitar that I've been doing. In the kind of aftermath of starting the REM show, which has gotten me thinking about music in a way that I haven't thought about it in a good long while.
That's really nice. Cool.
It's always good.
Yeah.
Yay! That's cool that the two loves can combine.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, Rocksmith is just a tablature machine for me. Like it is like the game parts of it are there, but it is not that huge. And so like, I mean, you know, like this stuff is probably going to fall into the background. Like the addition of bass, like I can confirm that the three tracks that they have, lead guitar, rhythm guitar, and then bass, all of those are fantastic. And just the amount of just kind of inherent teaching, not just of particular songs, but those component parts that goes on when you go in and just kind of repeat those loops over and over again is something very special. And I'm happy that it's a thing.
Yeah, it definitely feels like all three of those tracks got equal love.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't feel like bass was a throwaway.
No, it really doesn't. And even rhythm guitar, that is a tremendous amount of fun. to do as well. Mm-hmm. So if you're a person who has picked this up, you know, in the meantime, in the several years that Rocksmith has been a thing, like, don't neglect the rhythm track, because that is going to teach you chords that, you know, just not just chords, but like little embellishments and, you know, add or sus chords, you know, just little noodles that you do in between that, that are not going to be present in the lead, which has you doing mostly just kind of like single or double string stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The only other thing I've done has been a little bit of Dragon Quest Builders. Enough people talk sugar about it, and I played enough of the demo to say, like, yeah, this is definitely something that I will be into. It's a little hard to get used to playing on the Vita, because it is not a first-person game. It is a top-down kind of action RPG kind of thing. I expected it to be a little bit more of a first-person Minecraft, which is not necessarily that bad of a surprise, but, like, building things vertically takes a little bit of getting used to, because you have to use the shoulder buttons to, like, determine where your, like, building is going to be aimed. But, like, as this kind of free-form, goal-oriented action RPG, where you're satisfying little quests for people, it's pretty satisfying. I'm not far enough into it to really make that huge of a declaration about it, but it is definitely something special, and I'm very happy that it exists on Vita.
Cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that the I'm not sure exactly what is making it this way, but I feel like in Minecraft, the characters that inhabit the world feel very much in line with the blockiness of the world itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they all kind of follow that ethos, whereas the characters that show up in this world feel like they were characters from a normal video game kind of dropped into a blocky world.
Mm-hmm. Have you played it?
I have not. I'm looking at images.
Yeah. Like, you're seeing just kind of regular polygonal ass slimes and chimera running around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little goofy, but, like, it is not like the chunky 16x16 texture kind of thing that you're seeing. It is just the geometry that is kind of quantized to those cubes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as it's not as kind of off-putting as you would think in the actual process of play.
Yeah, I imagine once it's all in motion versus just in images, so you don't notice it as much.
Yep, so it's cool to have that little builder thing. It's been a while since I've engaged with a Minecraft-like kind of game.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, I'm curious what you've been playing.
It'll be super short. I've been playing XCOM. I've been playing Rocket League. Rocket League's still good. XCOM's even better than last week. XCOM's pretty awesome.
Specifically XCOM 2, right?
Yeah, XCOM 2, excuse me. Yeah, and again, I'm very surprised that I continually enjoy that game, because XCOM had a really high bar, but all the aliens that they've done in XCOM 2 are, like, pretty fantastic. Like, they're all just, like, a treat to find, even though they'll kill your entire squad, like, really easily.
But you're not playing Iron Man, so, you know, just lose a little bit of time.
I'm still deep in the save scum territory, so I'm doing that. But, I don't know, it's still fun. There's a cooler mechanic where you kind of have to take over the globe, like, territory by territory, and I can't remember what the equivalent was in the first XCOM. I know you kind of had to go through and increase your funding from each of the areas, but
you could I mean everything was available from the start in the first game, and you could put satellites over different areas.
That's right.
But this kind of inverts it in that you don't have access to everything. You have to expand out,
like, and so go ahead.
Oh, no. In one, it was like you're in maintenance mode. You had these continents that were part of XCOM, and you were trying to keep their panic down so they would stay in, right?
Yeah. Don't leave me. and this time, this one, you're slowly, like, taking back over the world. So you, like, have to explore different areas and kind of rebuild satellites in areas to kind of get a global connection. So it's kind of a good way to chart your progress. In addition, there's, like, a meter that's charting the aliens' progress of what they're guessing. Like, there's a project they're working on and you don't know what it is. And even now, I still have inklings of what it might be, but, whatever. But that kind of tells you how close you are until that's, like, probably a game over condition, maybe. I don't know what triggers at that point.
No.
So given those two sorts of meters, I'd say I'm probably a little bit over halfway done with the game, maybe two-thirds of the way through the game. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's really tough. There's a lot of saves coming. But it's getting to the point where the team's actually getting somewhat powerful and capable as you slowly like research more and more of the weapons. So it definitely has the same sort of feeling of accomplishment as the first game does. So
I have a question for you to reflect on the way I played. They, you know, at least in talking about the game when they developed XCOM 2, they made a huge effort to make the choices when upgrading a class more actually choices. Like in the first game, there was always kind of a clearly right choice every upgrade. Whereas in the second game, they had said, we want to make it a little more interesting. We want you to be able to mix and match and not feel like if you're going to optimize, you have to go a certain way. I didn't feel like they accomplished that. I felt like there was still a pretty obvious right choice each time. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you've done your character builds.
Yeah, I think maybe what they did is they made it more defined play styles in the two columns that you're choosing between. So whichever one you pick, you're going to pick that side probably entirely down the entire line. There's a few exceptions to that, but I think the one that comes to mind is like the Ranger class that they have. You can either do stealth or you can do basically run and gun, like basically what the class was in the last game. I will say with
and
that
I
one,
I felt like run and gun was the quote unquote right answer.
Yeah, that's the one I picked too. But I think that kind of I also would say that I'm not like a stealth player for the most part. There's very few games where I pick that option, so I don't know if that's I don't know if that completely invalidates it, but yeah, I could see that most people would choose the run and gun one just because it's a lot more fun and it seems pretty powerful. The other one that I'm thinking of that might be a close call is the specialist. There's basically attacker defense with the drones that they have. You can either use the drones to heal or you can use to attack other people. That one I think is more of like a tough choice because with the highest perk on that one, I chose the restoration one where you can heal multiple people. But with all the other ones, I chose a more aggressive attack one. So do you remember which one you chose for that one?
I remember that one being the one where I went back and forth. The XCOM adage of the best defense is to kill them before they can shoot you.
Yeah.
Applies there. So I mostly went with the attack related ones. If I remember correctly, that also branches into like hacking robot enemies, which my first playthrough on the given difficulty, I felt like, you know, wasn't as much of a problem. I think the second playthrough where I have, you know, I'm on a higher difficulty, I think mech enemies show up more frequently and it's more important to be able to hack them. So that might change my decision. But I definitely felt like for the sniper, especially because it's a sniper and they have one path for sniper rifles and one path for pistols, that choosing the sniper path was right. I felt like the Ranger's sword path or run and gun path was right. And then the I forget the two different paths for the Grenadier.
Yeah, the Grenadier, I know one was emphasis on grenades, which makes sense. I forget what their other one was. So I'm at a loss for that one. I will defend the sniper one. Just for fun, I made one of my snipers be the gunslinger, because that actually seemed kind of fun to me. There's some like cool perks with it where you can shoot everybody once within your sight. It has a similar one where if you take your first shot as a pistol shot and it kills someone, then you get it doesn't count as an action. They have one where you just get a free action of shooting with the pistol. So like all of those combined, you can get a pretty cool class. It's just a little bit hard to manage. You just need to make sure that that person can kind of run into the fray. So it's kind of a little bit counter to what the sniper typically does. But I definitely have one person doing that strategy because I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. I was so pigeonholed by my knowledge of the classes from the first game that I never tried it.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And I can't remember what the max out is for the pistol one. I have a one or two max out sniper people where this. I mean, the sniper perks are pretty powerful, just like in the last one where there's one where it's like a chain shot where you can basically take almost infinite shots as long as you kill people in your shots. So. Mm-hmm. That's definitely overpowered. There's squad sight and long sight, which is similar to what we had in the last game. So there's sniper is definitely, I think, one of the most powerful class probably. That's the only class that I've gotten consistent, like, you know, 18 or 19 attacks on people with them. So,
Yeah. Yeah. And one second before people write in to correct me, it is technically called the sharpshooter class in XCOM 2, which I guess could be applied to pistols, but whatever. It's a sniper.
Yeah.
Hey, Jella, whenever they talk, all I'm getting is snaps and hisses, like, and pops and stuff. Are you getting them?
No.
Okay.
Oh, right. No.
Okay. No.
Is it for either of us?
No, go ahead. Just keep on talking. I'm just being a dick. I hadn't talked in several minutes and I was starting to panic. I thought maybe I didn't exist anymore.
I thought you were
this
I was
is
like,
how
oh,
I feel. Existential crisis. I usually don't talk like after a while either. I feel so bad because, again, I never have anything to say about whatever Ben's playing because I don't have a frame of reference for it. So I always feel bad.
No, I was that was uncalled for. I was just being a dick.
I follow you. That's funny.
But yeah, I guess the other thing I've been impressed by with XCOM 2 is the enemies I think are really like unique, and they definitely change like the style of play that you have. And I think those are fun. And they're just like very charming, even though they're very like grotesque at certain times. I don't want to, there's one that I really love and would love to gush about, but it's kind of a spoiler. It's just like a joy to find out. So I'm, very I'll probably cool. continue playing these games over the next few weeks as well. So,
I'm happy you're having a good time.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
I don't have anything to add because that was all just frightening nonsense to me.
We got it out. It builds up. You have to get it out. You got to flush it out of your system.
No, I understand. So. Again, I'm being a dick.
Like it.
My takeaway was snipers are good, but I knew that.
Oh, man. Was that all you've been playing, Ben?
Yep.
Cool. And Dennis, round us out. Take us home.
Yeah, I will. I've got two. I tried another AAA PlayStation 4 game in Shadow of Mordor.
Okay.
And I'm sorry to say it's a kind of a second whiff for me.
Oh, wow. What was your first whiff?
Doom.
Okay, there we go. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I'm on a cold streak here. It's one of those games where you play it and you go, you know what? I'm really excited for the sequel. Just there's kind of good bones to it. It's got Assassin's Creed style combat, where kind of just that slow intentional tappa tappa of the right button at the right time.
Right.
That's fun. Oh, go ahead.
I would argue that it's Batman combat.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, sorry. That's what I meant. Batman combat. That Assassin's Creed then did borrow from.
Kind of counter based brawler kind of stuff.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really good. So there's good bones on that. I love me some Lord of the Rings, so I wouldn't mind seeing more games in that setting. But kind of the open world that they put around it feels very small in a very unfortunate way. Hmm. So the map, unless there's like a whole, another map that I can unlock that just they're not showing me or hinting at in any way, the map just feels almost claustrophobic. It's so small, especially for a game that's kind of structured like a Grand Theft Auto or an Assassin's Creed, where you kind of are given an open world and told to go any direction you want.
Yeah.
You can run across it in a matter of minutes.
Ben, you've mm-hmm. you've played this game. It expands, right? You go to different like neighborhoods, right?
There is another map. I hesitate saying this since it's kind of a spoiler, but yeah, there's another map.
Okay. So
well, that, you're that playing probably half of the total area.
Yeah, even then, that feels small, and it, I don't know, that got to me in a bad way. It felt like my choices of where to go were never meaningful, because I could always get to wherever I wanted like that. The little diversion side quest missions just aren't that inspiring. You know, you're hunting down random collectibles or, fighting, or hunting certain types of enemies. But it never really, did anything for me. It felt like housekeeping versus fun. The orc system, the hierarchy system in the game, which was really touted as something special they could only do on the PS4, I think that's another area where there's like really good bones.
And that is hyper intriguing to me, and I think that has potential. But at the end of the day, the orc army that it's kind of mapping out is maybe, what, 20 people? Like, there are four war chiefs. I wish there had been, like, 40 or something like that.
Yeah, like the Uruk-hai chieftain kind of people.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that feels like it's really cool the way that, based on who you kill and when and how, that impacts the, you know, the people that they're connected to in that hierarchy. But I felt like very, very early in the game, I was going after the war chiefs who were at the top of the pack. And just I was surprised that I got to that point so fast. And it felt very underwhelming when I killed a war chief. It was like, oh, that was like kind of the completion of the first quest line instead of, you know, the culmination of a lot of work. And the second one went down really easily as well. And in some point between the second and the third, I lost interest a little bit. So I would have loved to see, like, it's really cool. I haven't seen that done before in a game. I just wish they had gone even further into it.
Yeah. It's this weird, like, counterfactual thing. Like, I feel shitty asking you to say this, but, like, do you feel like just over the course of the past 3 years, it was just built up too much?
Yeah, no, I think that is fair, especially because the memory that I have of it, of the coverage of it, purported it as this amazing thing that could only be done on the PS4. And so maybe specifically to the orc hierarchy, the other stuff, there's not really an excuse for.
Like the nemesis system and the grudges that they can hold against
exactly.
you.
Yeah. Yeah. They took, hey, this is a cool idea. It's No Man's Sky syndrome, in, you know, retroactively applied, where they took a cool, like, interesting, quirky core idea and just made it seem like it was so much bigger than it actually was. I think they could get there, though. That would change the, you know, the way the game would have to be built. But like I said, I look forward to the sequel on that. Final thought on the game is there must have been a design meeting where the team got together and said, okay, what is the cardinal sin that this game could commit? What is the absolute worst thing that could happen in this game? And someone said, I think it's if the character falls off a ledge when the player doesn't intend them to. And no one was willing to speak up and say it's not that big a deal. Because the amount of effort that you have to put to just drop off a ledge is Herculean. Like, unless you are, like, running all out at the ledge, just, you know, at takeoff speed, in which case you'll jump from it. There is, like, it is a process. You have to, like, hold down the circle button for about 5 minutes before the game is like, okay, he must. Okay, I'm sure now. Yeah, okay, he's been holding it long enough. I'm sure now.
Dennis, you call that a frustration. I call it a triumph. Finally, cautious boys get proper representation, okay? This is cautious boys' revenge.
This is the cautiousest of boys. it's just a really weird decision that even to the point where, like, you climb up a tower and you can kind of get to the top of the wall and you're looking down into, like, the sniper's nest at the top of the tower. And so many times I want to drop in and kill the archer, and I felt like I couldn't do that. Like, I took out the archer with an arrow, and so I climbed to the top of the tower and I just wanted to stand where the archer was standing, and I couldn't do that. Like, it kept on either jumping to the opposite ledge or hanging and then climbing back up. And, like, it so cautious, specifically about dropping from ledges. Everything else he does pretty aggressively. It just kind of a really weird quirk to it.
Right.
That reminds me of, like, when I was talking about Castlevania Dracula X Chronicles, and I'm like, he's just not in a hurry. He's just got to strut that rodeo jacket he's wearing. he will not run to save his life, you know? But anyway, go on.
Yeah, for sure. So that's Shadow of Mordor. I do have one question. Announce a sequel. Okay, go ahead.
I'm not too prepared to talk about it since I haven't played it in so long, I haven't thought about it in a while. But did they have one mechanic? Because you said that the bosses went down easily. One of my memories of the game is that they had a cool system where, like, when you kind of invade a base or whatever where a general is, and you try and, like, take down people silently first so that the alarms don't go off. But then, like, as you start openly attacking people, like, doesn't, like, an alarm system, like, go up and up and up, and, like, soon it becomes, like, almost impossible to take them out if you wait long enough and without killing the target? Is that the case? Is my memory at all correct to what the game is? Or
you definitely, if you go in loud, you will be so swarmed with regular orcs while you're trying to fight the main guy that it's impossible. Honestly, I think that first path of, you know, killing the ranks of the first war chief and then ultimately killing the first war chief is kind of treated as a tutorial. And again, that was underwhelming. But so that fight was really not very hard. His weaknesses, like, he was a tougher enemy, but his weaknesses were animals? Still fairly obvious. What was he weak to? It was like the special attacks, the circle and triangle, which you're doing in combat anyway. The second one, this is funny. Like, they touted making them so unique and special each time, and I can't remember what was special about them. But yeah, the second one, I think I just lucked out. I don't know, but I didn't think the fight was that hard. And it might have been that his weakness happened to be, you know, roll the dice, and it happened to be to normal attacks or something. Because the third guy that I went after, and I died to him once or twice, was he was only really vulnerable to ranged attacks or mounted attacks, and there weren't any mounts in his area.
Okay.
And so, you know, that made him difficult. But I got to him so fast. Like, I was really incredibly easily able to figure out who he was and where he was, and it didn't feel like getting to him was a process. It just all happened very fast. And I actually had all of the war chiefs revealed, and like knew all of their strengths and weaknesses. Now it was just a matter of going and getting them. Whereas I think really what I would have loved to see is more of a process of discovery and intrigue, which is what they promised.
Maybe like a taller pyramid.
Exactly. Yep. Mm.
Gotcha.
Not even necessarily wider, just deeper.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want an obelisk. as opposed to a pyramid, but what I got was an anthill.
Don't even come at me with a ziggurat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
What else have you been playing?
I also dived into Sunless Sea for a little bit.
Yeah, I saw that on sale over the weekend.
Yeah, it's a fun little game. A really interesting blend of text-based adventure, which I know, like Fallen London, which the game is based on, is primarily all done through like Twitter and text.
Yeah.
And then actually like a physical interface, and you're traversing across a map with the ship. And those blended together better than I thought they would initially. There are some hiccups, just the coding on it, where like you'll mouse over some item and it'll say like, you have a god's attitude towards you as a status in your inventory. And it's actually like an inventory item that you can see.
Weird.
And I totally get how, if it was just a text-based game, that's kind of like the only place that you could put it. And so if someone needs to like, you know, type check inventory or whatever to see it, it makes sense there. But because there's more elegant visual ways of representing it, they could have done it better. But it feels like they just didn't put too much thought into, you know, how the visual piece could expedite things.
Yeah.
But like I said, overall, it blends together really, really well. The game is full of really quirky, interesting ideas. And I know David's talked about some of them on the show. So he mentioned, you know, founding a civilization of guinea pigs on one island that he discovered.
Yeah.
I chose to go a different direction. I founded a civilization of rats. So, you know,
I'm not convinced they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just a rebranding kind of thing.
That's interesting that there's like these ancient, salt lions. So it's giant sculptures made out of salt that, instead of people like building them or exploring them, they're actively dismantling them. And I really like that idea of like, here's this horrifying ancient artifact of, you know, of course we want to get rid of it. We got to disassemble it. that's the project. So that's kind of cool. So I've enjoyed kind of that first round of exploration. I was also pleasantly surprised. So it's designed to be a roguelike, where you are going to die and you pass down some of what you accumulated to the next person. And you then set out as that person. the game was almost like overly cautious in telling me it was going to be okay when I died. Like the screenplay was like, "You're dead. It's okay. These things happen." Like literally in those words.
Yeah.
Like try again, and like the loading screens all have messages of like, you know, death is going to happen. It's all right. They kind of sensed that you would be incensed by losing your captain. And I was when I died the first time, because I've only died once. I died in such a stupid way, which was I got distracted typing to people on chat in Steam.
Yeah.
Didn't pay attention to where I was going and wandered into an enemy that took me out.
Oops.
Could have easily avoided him, but just wasn't paying enough attention.
Yeah.
I think that highlights an interesting balance in the game, because the game does have a lot of low points, or if you know, negatively, you could say dull points, where you've explored this area of the ocean before. Mm-hmm. You're going to X island for Y quest, and it's just going to take some time to get there.
Yeah.
And if I felt like that was unintentional, I'd be really annoyed with it and pissed off and be like, they're not being considerate of my time. But I feel like that with the general atmosphere that the game is going for, and kind of this lonely horror of being out in a dark sea with no reference for land, you don't know what's around you, and your resources are kind of just gradually dwindling away, and you're just not sure if you're going to have enough to get where you're going or not. Like, it feels like those low points or that those slow times are really designed into that atmosphere. So yeah. I'm more okay with it. And so, you know, a smack of the hand for me for checking Twitter while I'm going from place
yeah,
to
yeah, yeah.
And not reveling in that experience. So that, you know, that was interesting. Once I had my bearings for my first character, it took very little time for my second character to have the map as explored as the first character did.
Yeah.
So very much a knowledge compresses space game.
Right.
But I've reached the point again now where I'm kind of floundering for what to do next. I don't really have enough money to do the run. Like, I need to invest 200 coins here to make 500 there, and that was my primary way of making money. Uh-huh. But I don't have 200 coins right now, and I'm not really sure how to build back up to the right amount of money.
Seems like so the kind of game where, like, checking a wiki or talking with the community might not be a problem.
Yeah, and I think it's very much assumes that, like, hey, thing Y sells for X in port Z and for B in port A.
Right.
And so just run back and forth between those two. I imagine I can find that pretty easily if I look it up. I feel a little bad that I've gotten this far in the game without doing that, and that has led to a lot of more organic exploration. Whereas when I break down, and I think it will be a when, and just look up where I need to go to make the money that I want to have, that'll be a little bit of disillusionment.
But, yeah.
Overall, the experience of playing the game has been worth it. And the stuff that I've found, just kind of reading and experiencing that, has been rewarding enough that I don't think I'll lose too much by just looking for where to go next.
Hey, Dennis, do you have like a washing machine running in the background?
I was tapping my leg while I was talking.
Yeah, that's creating like a weird like washing machine kind of thing. It's not like terrible, but I just want to make sure it doesn't go on. Okay,
but I'm actually podcasting from a train.
Okay, no. Just
no, but that sums up my thoughts on Sunless Sea.
Cool. Yeah. I don't know that I have anything else to add besides that is a game that I hope to eventually play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
get it before Sunless Skies comes out,
I suppose. But then when Sunless Sky comes out, that'll be content complete. So then I can play it without worrying that something will be added on top of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do I want to button it up?
Let's.
Okay.
Buttons.
We have some other stuff to do, so I want to make sure that we keep this pretty short. If you want to help the show out, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes. We love, love, love it when people talk about the show on social media or message boards. If you can help spread the word, that is literally the only way that our audience grows, is by people telling friends and acquaintances or shouting it from rooftops or whatever. So please do whatever you can. You know, if you like this thing, tell a friend, hey, you might like this thing too. Yeah.
From the rooftop.
From the rooftop. I mean, like, how else will they know you mean it? So, there's that in the Patreon and other shows on the network. Huge, big stuff. Am I forgetting anything?
You're forgetting everything, Cole.
Yes, I am forgetting everything.
anything outside of everything, though.
Right.
Diagram that sentence.
Okay. So I've been Cole Ross at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I've been Dennis Furia at D Furia on Twitter. I thought you were just going to say your name for a second. I was panicking, not knowing if I should follow suit or what.
Too, again, I forgot how to do this. Hey, Jala, who are you?
I'm Jala-chan in places.
Who am I?
Hey, Ben, who are you?
You're Mergalizer sometimes on Twitter.
Yep. And stick around for some titles. I'm not doing that every time. I'm not prompting every individual person. You should know the order by this point. Any titles that you want to throw in?
Yeah, I got some.
Okay.
Got a lot.
Most of them are Dennis-centric. Dennis, ooh, you're just like attention hog this time. Okay, so
my list of titles is The Cole Show, so.
Oh.
Okay, Lord Your Chalice.
Lord Your Chalice.
That's what you were talking about when you were like, Lord Your Chalice, because you've got the big cup
at the
beer festival. Daddy's Sick, Lukey.
can I just put that down to Daddy's Sick?
Sure.
Okay.
Apropos of basically nothing.
I have that one as well.
Okay. Apocalypse Later. Spooky Secret Algorithms. Also, Dennis's Sunday Morning.
Okay.
Cautious Boys Revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, The Cautiousest of Boys.
Cautiousest of Boys. Okay.
That's it.
All right. Dennis, what you got?
Yeah, I've got Mutually Assured Humiliation.
I had that as well. That was my one.
Yeah.
Yep. I've got Explosions, Rugrat style. Sorry, spelled Rugrat style, not Rugrat style in the title. So just Explosions. And then I also had Cautious Boys Revenge. But Cautious Boys was spelled CautiousBoix.
Of course. That's how I wrote it. Come on. You can talk to me, man.
I should know. Game recognized game.
Yeah. Well, you got anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay. Ben, what you got?
All right. I also had Apropos of Basically Nothing. I had Everything is a Combination of Everything. I had That's Why You Never Prepare. I also had Apocalypse Later. I also had Mutually Assured Humiliation. I had Floor Gumbo.
That was from off air.
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah.
But also from off air, I had Siphoning from the Rug Doctor. I liked that one. And then Accidental Cosplay. Ooh. Polygonal Ass Slimes. And The Cautious.
I almost
heard
that was like, that won't get through.
Yeah.
And what was the last one?
The Cautiousest of Boys.
Cautiousest of Boys. Okay, so the ones that there may have been one that I missed in the middle of yours, Ben. You rattled them off pretty quick, but I think I got them. The two that have the most, or the three that have the most notes or votes: Mutually Assured Humiliation, Apropos of Basically Nothing, and Apocalypse Later. Do we have any favorite between all of those?
I would say, well, Cautious Boys Revenge and Cautiousest of Boys showed up in different forms, but I also want to have one of those in the running.
Okay. I like Cautious Boys Revenge more, unless
Same.
Jala.
I'm pretty good with all of them. I have no preference.
Okay. Jala.
I like Apropos of Basically Nothing, personally, but...
Okay. that's the tiebreaker. Apropos of Basically Nothing. There we go.
Cool.
Cool. Let us, sorry, Ben, to kick you off. Let us do
no
this
problem.
Machinarium thing relatively quickly. I mean, not like rush it or anything, but you time stretch there.
Unintentionally being a robot.